We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus, our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Last month, a web organization called WikiLeaks released thousands of classified military documents relating to the war in Afghanistan. And it's very clear that the people behind WikiLeaks believe that transparency in government is very important and helps build stronger democracies. Critics, however, say the release of such information is both irresponsible and damaging to American security. This morning in this hour of the program, we'll be talking with Jeffrey Stone. He's professor of law at the University of Chicago, and we'll be talking about balancing government's need for secrecy against the public's right to know. And we think of this as being a kind of a continuation of a conversation that we began a couple of weeks ago on the program when we talked with Gabriel Schoenfeld about his new book, which is titled Necessary Secrets. In that book, he makes the argument that the U.S. has not done enough to keep secrets secret, that the press has not shown enough restraint when it comes to publishing these things. It's something that he believes is getting worse. And in the book, his ultimate argument is that the press, the media, should indeed be prosecuted if they publish this kind of material. Our guest for this hour, Jeff Stone, has been a member of the law faculty at University of Chicago since 1973. He also served as dean of the law school and provost of the university. He teaches and writes mainly in the area of constitutional law, and among his recent books are three I'll mention because they definitely deal with the topic we're talking about. One is Top Secret: When Our Government Keeps Us in the Dark. Another, War and Liberty, An American Dilemma, and a book that got a lot of attention, his book, Perilous Times, Free Speech in Wartime, from the Sedition Act of 1798 to the War on Terrorism. So if you'd like to read on the subject, you certainly can go out and look for his books. Questions are welcome here on the program. We do ask people, please make it a question, make it on the topic, and be brief. That way we can accommodate as many people as would like to be involved in the conversation. And certainly we do like to get in people's comments. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. And you may also send along your questions by email. And the address is will-talk@illinois.edu. Professor Stone, hello.
Hi, good morning.
Thank you very much for talking with us. We appreciate it. I want to ask you about something here, and it did certainly seem to be the case when we talked with Mr. Schoenfeld, that he felt that this issue, that is the publication, the release of classified information, was something that he felt was accelerating, was getting worse, was more of an issue now than it had been in the past. Do you think that that is the case?
Well, it's complicated because what's happened in part is that the government has classified more and more aggressively. And as a consequence, it has classified more and more material that doesn't dramatically threaten the national security. So if you go back into the past, until relatively recently, the government was very careful about classification, but it's become, as I say, much more aggressive about it, and the consequence is that there's inevitably going to be more leaks and more publications of material that really shouldn't have been classified in the first place.
Mm-hmm. And I do think, actually, that Mr. Schoenfeld would at least agree in principle that there's much that ends up being classified that doesn't need to be, although I would imagine that he and you would disagree on individual things on whether they should or should not be classified.
I mean, that's probably right. My guess is that Schoenfeld would think that more material is justifiably classified than would be my view. Yeah, I'm sure that's right.
Just to hear, maybe this is a kind of obvious question, but I'll ask it anyway. What is the value of having as much transparency in government as possible?
Well, in a democracy, individual citizens have to be able to hold their elected officials accountable, have to be able to evaluate their performance and decide whether or not they should be reelected and kept in power, and the individual citizens and the citizenry as a whole has a right to make decisions about whether certain policies should go forward or should be employed or should not be employed. So, although we elect our representatives for the purpose of representing us, don't elect them for the purpose of governing us. In a self-governing society, which is what we aspire to be, individual citizens should be informed as much as possible about what the government is doing so it can fulfill its responsibility of being the governors.
Mm-hmm. We talked about the tendency, particularly recently, to classify material, and I think that some people would say that it's something that that has been done in a bipartisan manner. That is the sense, you know, it doesn't matter whether you're talking about a Republican or a Democratic administration, that both of them.
That's not true.
No?
No. The Clinton administration, for example, declassified a huge amount of material that had been classified under earlier administrations, and was very proud of the fact that it did that. So, no, I don't think that's true. I think in general, Republican administrations in recent times, say the last 30 or so years, have been more inclined than Democratic administrations to be aggressive in classification. And that's not surprising. I mean, in general, Republicans, conservatives, tend to value what they see as national security to a greater degree than Democrats, and Democrats tend to give greater value to transparency than Republicans. So you see that in the stances the party takes on all sorts of issues when legislation, for example, comes up. So it's not surprising that you see that difference. It is not the case that it's been equal.
Hmm. And when things are classified, is that are people really taking a look at the individual document, what it contains, or is this more of a reflexive kind of a reaction that says, well, they're sort of more inclined to classify than not, and maybe it doesn't always matter what it is, that what the content is.
Right. Well, the problem is there's so much material. It's you know, basically, it borders on infinite as a practical matter, that comes within the purview of, you know, every phone call that's intercepted, every email that's intercepted. It's an enormous amount of information. And as a consequence, it's impossible to have a careful process to review these decisions. So what winds up happening is that many, or probably most classification decisions, are made by people relatively far down the food chain. And they know that they will get in a lot more trouble if they don't classify something that should have been classified than if they do classify something that shouldn't be. And they know they're much more likely to be caught in their error if they underclassified, because then the information gets released and somebody says, who the hell did this? Who didn't classify this thing? Whereas if they overclassify, the odds are extremely high that the information will never be brought to light a day and nobody will ever know they made a mistake. So the temptation is very much to overclassify, and that's part of the problem.
Mm-hmm. That is, it seems that in many cases what they're trying to avoid is not so much the release of information damaging to national security as often something that's just potentially embarrassing, that just doesn't make them look very good.
Well, what do you mean by them? I mean, I don't think that the individual public officials who are doing the classifying are trying to keep the government from being embarrassed. I think they're probably in good faith trying to do their jobs. But they're doing their jobs with a very large distortion built into the process, which is that they perceive it as a much bigger mistake to underclassify than to overclassify. And so they overclassify. The embarrassment issue comes in probably at higher levels of government, where members of administration are naturally, this is human nature, are much more likely to want to classify information that will be embarrassing but not threatening to the national security, or that will be politically difficult for them, like, say, the torture program. So they may believe the torture program was completely legitimate, or the NSA surveillance program was completely legitimate, but nonetheless they don't want to know, not so much because of embarrassment, because of the fact that it will cause real political difficulty for them. And for all those reasons, there's a tendency to overclassify. There's almost never a tendency to underclassify, unless, of course, you're embarrassing your predecessor administrations or the opposite party.
Hmm. Our guest in this hour of Focus is Jeffrey Stone. He teaches law at University of Chicago. His main area is constitutional law. He's done a lot of writing on the subject that we're talking about here this morning, that is secrecy in government. And questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu. I think people in the media have this strong commitment to the idea that transparency in government is important, that the public really does indeed need to know about the workings of government. And so they argue that attached to this public need to know is a right of the press to publish, that otherwise how else is the public going to know? Does indeed the press, and we'll extend that and say someone who does their distributing with the Internet like WikiLeaks, do they have a right to publish information that government wants to keep secret?
Oh, absolutely. The Supreme Court made that very clear in the Pentagon Papers case, where the court held that publishers have a First Amendment right to disseminate information, regardless of whether the government claims that it's harmful to the national security, unless, at the very least, the government can prove that the publication would be likely imminently to cause a grave harm to the national security.
Hmm.
So, short of that relatively small box, sure, there's a huge amount of material that the government classifies that could not satisfy that standard, and that the publishers reveal it, but they certainly could not constitutionally be punished for disclosing the information. Again, simple examples would include the NSA surveillance program, the existence of it, the existence of the torture program, the rendition program. Those are all major government activities that the publication of which might in some ways harm the national security. I don't think anybody could rationally argue that revelation of those materials wouldn't in some way harm the national security. But at the same time, no one seriously could argue that they are likely imminently to cause grave harm to the national security.
Mm.
And therefore, publishers are free to publish them, and that's why there's often any prosecutions in those situations. Another very simple example is the administration declined to release photographs, additional photographs of alleged torture in Iraq and in Afghanistan. This is the Obama administration refused to release those photographs because they thought it would be harmful to national security to have the visual images disseminated throughout the world, and they therefore refused to disclose the information. The photographs. But if someone leaked those photographs and a newspaper published them, there's no question at all that the newspaper would be constitutionally protected in doing so.
Mm. It seems that this is the most difficult case, really. There may be a lot of material that's classified that may perhaps most people would argue doesn't need to be classified. Then there might indeed be classified material where we would be generally in agreement that national security or lives would be endangered if it was published, and there that the cost outweighed the benefits. The difficult case is the one that says there is some material that does have security implications, but that should be made public anyway because the benefits of disclosure outweigh the cost. That's the most difficult case.
Yes and no. If you were going to define the law that way, that is a court or government or whatever is going to decide whether the benefit to the public of knowing outweighs the harm to the national security, that would be an exceedingly difficult question to answer because these are incommensurable values. How do you really assess in a measured, careful way the value of a particular publication of information to the public? And how do you realistically assess the harm to national security? That's a very difficult judgment because you're balancing apples and oranges, and that we don't have any measure on which we can quantify these values. And for that reason, the court never does that. The approach the courts have taken to this issue is to simplify the inquiries in order to avoid anyone having to address that particular question. So what they've done is adopt two easy-to-administer standards, which are very much at variance. So the employee, under existing law, can be criminally punished or disciplined as an employee for releasing classified information as long as there is a reasonable ground to believe that the publication of the information would harm the national security. No one balances the value of the speech against the harm. The standard that's applied is if the employee knowingly published information that could reasonably be said to violate, to harm the national security. And then on the publisher side, it's flipped. And on the publisher side, the court says that the publisher cannot be punished for disclosing information that has been unlawfully leaked unless the publication of that information would be likely imminently to cause a grave harm to the national security, which, again, is not asking the same question of balancing the benefit against the harm. So what you have is this sort of what's seemingly anomalous situation in which no one's asking the, quote, right question, which is, does the benefit outweigh the harm? Because it's almost an impossible question to answer in the facts of a particular case. And it's instead, what the court has done is create this kind of awkward compromise in which it gives the government a great deal of authority to keep information confidential in the first place, including by punishing its employees, but then taking the view that if the government cannot effectively keep information secret, and if it's really important for you to keep it secret, then you should be able to figure out how to accomplish that goal. But if you don't succeed in that, then the press is going to be free to disseminate the information except in the most extraordinary of circumstances. So it's a weird compromise, but the idea is that by having these two very different standards that we wind up in a reasonably good place in the end.
Let's take a caller. We'll talk with someone here in Piatone on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Yes, thank you. Thank you very much. I appreciate being able to use my Fifth Amendment here. Our First Amendment. You know, I'll tell you, I think personally, and this is my opinion, and I know people are going to hate what I say, but I'm going to say it anyway. The media has no right for some of this top secret stuff to be leaked, whether it's declassified or classified. The war is a good example. I think there's a lot of things being said out there that ought not to be. You're putting lives in danger. You know, I mean, if you were in the same situation, you have a son and a daughter out there that are fighting the cause, and you've got some media specialists out there throwing things out they ought not to be. I think it's a little bit unfair. I think the media, because they want to sensationalize a lot of things, it's kind of gotten out of hand. And it's just like me talking like I am now. You got to be able to have the freedom of speech and say what you want. But at the same time, I'm not going to say things that ought not to be said on the radio. And I think the same thing should be said for the media. It needs to put a cap on it, especially if they know there's something here that it might get some people in trouble, don't you think?
Well, Professor Stone, what do you think?
Well, the problem, the difficulty with that argument is that it proves too much, and it has historically always proved too much. So, for example, during the First World War, the Wilson administration faced a problem. The First World War was not very popular, and there was a lot of opposition to the war right from the outset. Because most Americans didn't really know, or couldn't really understand why we were entering this carnage in the first place. And so one of the things Wilson needed to do was to rally the people. And so one of the ways he did that is by having Congress enact the Espionage Act of 1917 and the Sedition Act of 1918, which effectively made it a crime for any person to criticize the war or the draft. And the argument in favor of that law was that such speech encourages the enemy, it discourages people from joining the military, and it undermines and endangers the war effort and therefore puts American soldiers at risk. And the Supreme Court basically looked at that and said, well, yeah, this speech does have the tendency to have that effect. And rather than balancing the value of the speech, which in this case was criticism of the legitimacy and morality or effectiveness of the war and the draft, it basically said, well, as long as it might put lives at risk, the government can suppress the speech. And the effect of that was that no criticism of a war was allowed, and any criticism could be criminal and criminally punished. Imagine if we were fighting the wars we've been fighting over the last dozen years, in the last 8 years, in a situation in which no one could legally criticize the invasion of Iraq or the way in which the war in Iraq was being fought or the decision to go into Afghanistan. If we couldn't criticize it, that maybe, the government could claim, would protect lives, but it would completely denude our democracy of any effectiveness. So the problem with that argument is that it puts too much trust in the government. And one of the critical things in a democracy is people should always distrust their government and not be naive about the motivations of public officials. And second, it's that the ability to restrict speech on the plea that the speech might cause bad consequences is limitless. And essentially, there is no free speech if the government can say that this speech might cause harm to the society or to the government, and therefore we're going to prohibit it. If that becomes the conception of free speech, then the government can essentially make almost any speech critical of the government a crime.
And I think it also, you know, the kind of hypothetical that the caller suggests, and a lot of people will suggest, I think that looking at the record of publishing classified or controversial material, I think one would have to say that at least since the post-war period, you can't really point to anything that satisfies that the demands of the hypothetical, I think.
Well,
or can you?
I mean, the interesting thing is that there's never in the entirety of American history been a prosecution of the press, let alone a conviction,
mm-hmm.
for publishing information, secrets, that harmed the national security. That is, even long before we had the classification system as such, the press has essentially been sufficiently responsible about what it's done so as to preclude the government from prosecuting them for their actions. The closest the government ever came was in the Pentagon Papers case, and that was an injunction, not a criminal prosecution. So, yes, I agree with you. I think that in general, if you look over the course of history, there is a risk, of course, that the publication of this kind of information will cause harm, but the question is not whether it causes harm. Almost all speech can cause harm. It's rather whether the harm caused is so grave that it's appropriate to silence individuals from revealing that information to the public. And the history suggests that this really hasn't been a problem. Now, might there be a case where it would be a problem? Of course. A classic hypothetical would be a situation, for instance, in which the names of all of America's undercover operatives in Afghanistan are published, and they are then either murdered or forced to leave the country, so two terrible things happen. These individuals are killed, and or we lose our legitimate undercover activities in Afghanistan. Were that to happen, the government might well be justified, and the court might well uphold the government's action of criminally prosecuting the entity that published that information for two reasons, or two reasons both being present. One is that it would be a situation where there was a likely and imminent and grave harm to the national security. And second, the information itself, the names of these operatives, is not really relevant to or helpful to public discourse. You don't need those names in order to evaluate your government's policies. And therefore, in that situation, one might say that, yeah, there's really no public need for the information at all, and that the harm to the national security is likely imminent and grave. But that's one of those hypotheticals, like the torturer with the time bomb, inside the Empire State Building, and you've got 3 minutes to go, and you capture the guy who planted it, and can you torture him? I mean, it's an interesting hypothetical, but it has nothing to do with the real world.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580, is Jeff Stone. He's a professor of law at the University of Chicago, has been on the faculty there since 1973. He's also served as the dean of the law school and also provost of the university. He writes and teaches mostly in the area of constitutional law. And I want to just again mention titles of three recent books because they all deal with the subject that we are talking about. His most recent is Top Secret, When Our Government Keeps Us in the Dark. Also, War and Liberty, An American Dilemma, and the book that he wrote that got a lot of attention, got some awards, Perilous Times, Free Speech in Wartime, from the Sedition Act of 1798 to the War on Terrorism. And we're talking about government secrecy and how one balances the public's right to know the importance of open government against the idea that, yes, indeed, some things do need to remain secret. Questions are welcome. Again, we ask people to please make it a question, keep it brief, and stay on the topic. But your comments are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu. Another caller here, someone up next, and they are in Urbana, and line one.
Hi.
Yes.
I have 3 points, really quick. One is I see it very much as the WikiLeaks as being a whistleblower situation, and it should be as simple as that. And the second thing,
what situation?
The WikiLeaks, releasing the documents to the WikiLeaks, as a whistle, just like a company, a whistleblower on a company that said that, you know, like that research in tobacco. Well, anyway, so just like whistleblowing for against a company that did something wrong, and so releasing these documents about what the government is doing wrong or what the military is doing wrong is just like a whistleblower.
He's a whistleblower is the word I didn't get. Okay.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, and then the second thing is the justice system. So since it was a military person, they will be probably tried by the military justice, which is different than the typical justice that we as civilians actually experience. And it actually, I think it needs to be in civilian justice system. And the third situation that I want to mention is in direct response to the last caller who was saying that it was endangering other people's lives. And I think in a democracy, it is our responsibility to make sure that our military and our government does not ask our young people to go and risk their lives needlessly for a illegal and immoral war. And those are the 3 points that I want you to respond to. Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
Well, the whistleblowing example is correct insofar as the question is prosecuting a government employee who releases the information. The employee may have a range of motivations. The whistleblower, in conventional sense, has only the motivation of wanting to reveal the activities of her employer that are harmful or illegal. And wants to bring them to the light of day so the company can be held accountable. There's also the situation, both in the private context and in the national security context, of course, where the employee has less admirable motivations. So the employee might be a spy, for example, whose purpose is not at all about revealing bad behavior by the government, but is, in fact, designed to undermine the effectiveness of the government. And that could be dealt with by prosecutions for espionage. And you don't need to publish or to prosecute the publication of the information. And whistleblowers themselves, it's not clear what level of First Amendment protection they would have if the government were to intervene. But all the other protection they have is statutory. That is, it's statutory law that gives private whistleblowers a protection against retaliation by their employers. As for the court system that would be employed in prosecuting the leaker, to the extent the leaker is a member of the military, which is sometimes the case and sometimes not the case, then I don't know enough about the military justice system to know the jurisdictional boundaries, but my guess is that your inference is right, that the person would be prosecuted in a military proceeding rather than in a civilian proceeding. And the really, the objection to that is less about distrust of the military system in this particular case than it is about distrust of the military system more generally. And on the whole, I think the military justice system has worked reasonably well. I'm not sure why it needs to exist, frankly, except for very specialized circumstances where the illegal conduct involves actions that are peculiarly within the nature of the military. So it's not obvious to me why there needs to be a military prosecution, for example, rather than a civilian prosecution of an individual who leaks classified information. It's a problem that exists in both environments, both the civilian environment and the military environment, and courts handle it perfectly well in the civilian environment, so there's no obvious reason why it needs to be put in a military tribunal just because the leaker was a soldier. So I agree with you that that's a sensible objection. And the third point was the need for people to know their son and daughter is going off into the army. It's true they don't want them put at risk, but it's also true that they want to make sure that if they're at risk, it's for a good reason,
right. And
not just to serve the political advantages of the president. And that's exactly right, and I think that's true. The difficulty with again, to come back to the point, the difficulty with the argument that when a life is put at risk, that in itself is justification for restricting speech. There's lots of things we do put lives at risk. Freedom puts lives at risk. Limiting the ability of the government to conduct searches, limiting the ability of the government to force people to incriminate themselves, all sorts of free speech interests make society less safe in terms of the sort of short-term interests of individuals. But that's the price of freedom. I mean, that's what freedom is about. We could be very safe if we lived in a society in which there was no freedom. So every freedom in that respect creates risks to individuals, including risks to their lives, but that's the choice that we make. And there's nothing distinctive about this risk relative to the others that arise.
It's clear that maybe what the WikiLeaks people are doing is something in the nature of whistleblowing. Clearly, as far as the law is concerned, they're not whistleblowers. But I do wonder whether, as far as the law is concerned, does the law view them the same way that the law would view, for example, the New York Times?
Yes.
Yes.
I mean, apart from the fact that they're based in another country, which is a complication jurisdictionally, but apart from that, yes, they're no different than the New York Times. No different than the London Observer, for example.
To Effingham next, line four. Hello.
Thank you, David. I hope this is on target. Does your guest think that Nathan Hale was executed by the British and that was just? When he spied, he gave out information, caught him, and they hung him or executed him.
Do I think it was just? Well, a spy is a little different because the way we think about espionage is that the individual does not have the good motivation and that they are acting not as a loyal individual who is trying to improve our society, even though they may be opposed to our particular president or government at a moment, or policies at a moment, but their motivations are generally to be good citizens as they see good citizenship.
Would you allow that spying is part and parcel to the WikiLeaks and a lot of other things and the Pentagon Papers? And
a spy working for another government.
For another government. So that changes the paradigm.
Well,
if you work for another government, they catch you, they kill you, and that's justified or injustice.
Well, I mean, the argument is, first of all, it's important to remember that the public employee under existing law can be punished.
Yeah, well, I mean,
Gay Ellsberg, for example, who leaked the Pentagon Papers, could have been convicted, even though the New York Times and the Washington Post could not be punished for publishing the information that he leaked. Similarly, the member of the military who leaked this information to WikiLeaks, in all likelihood, can be punished under existing law. So even if somebody's not a spy, if they're a leaker and they leak information that reasonably could harm the national security, they can be punished. And that's That's pretty clear under existing law.
And the recent flap with the Russians and the U.S. and the spy thing all up again is, if I'm understanding, is a completely different venue.
I'm not sure what the facts are in the situation you're referring to.
Well, it was just in all over the news where there were 12 or 14 Russians.
Oh, that story. Right. Okay.
Yeah.
I got you.
Yeah.
Well, if you can prove that they, being a spy in and of itself, is not a serious offense unless you've actually been in a position where you can do something harmful. But, yes, I mean, the law does recognize the distinction between individuals who are working on behalf of a foreign nation and are trying to elicit classified information from this government and American citizens who do so. And it's mainly about motive. I mean, the difference is mainly about motive. I drew that distinction very early on. In the same way that an American citizen who criticizes the war during wartime should be protected by free speech, but a Tokyo Rose could be punished because they were seen as waging war against the United States.
I think
opposed to being a loyal American citizen criticizing American policies. So, you raise an interesting question as to what extent there is a compelling distinction between foreign agents and American citizens. But I think there is, and I think the difference is the assumption that the foreign agent is not operating to benefit the United States.
And you hear, in that particular case, maybe this is a fine point, but I think in the particular case of these 10 or 12 Russians who were deported, I think the allegation was by the FBI that their purpose in being here was to spy, but that in fact they never did come up with any classified information. And then I think the only thing that they could charge them with was being unregistered agents of a foreign government.
Right. Right, which is why if they did prosecute them, they couldn't have done very much to them.
Yeah. All right. Let's go to another caller here, line one, in Urbana. Hello.
Oh, hi. How are you? Hmm? Interesting you're discussing World War II because the scale of that operation or those operations was much larger. It was almost like as if you would go back into the time and read the literature. It was like a fight for the survival of liberal democracy versus fascism. So the strength of the inhibitions of free speech and stuff and the secrecies involved were paramount, like D-Day operations and operations out in the Western in the Pacific. But in modern wars, they're more or less regional small-scale wars like Vietnam, the Korean conflict, and Afghanistan. So they're really sort of away from the awareness of the people like the United States. In Europe, they're not really that involved, vicariously maybe if their children are involved or something like that. So most of this stuff comes through after the fact. Like the WikiLeaks papers, which I've been reading, are mostly just military operation lingo. You get all the, you know, operation this, that. Some of these things have been edited. But if you watch the video of the helicopter shooting down the Reuters, and the only reason this was even noticed because the Reuters reporter was killed. If you watch the video, counter to what is said about it, three of the people with him were carrying automatic weapons and one was carrying an RPG. So I'm assuring there were security for him. Of course, the chopper pilots probably didn't know that. But it's interesting that how this blows up into be some sort of argument between, you know, right to know versus secrecy. And you know, in a way, people are paranoid about the secrecy because the government comes off as being lying, and in a sense, in actual field operations, you really want to protect the soldiers involved. So you can't just tell them, oh, we're going to be here tomorrow, and, you know, broadcast it at the New York Times. So I'm just wondering what you say about that. But I'm all for free speech, but there are limitations to that in military operations. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
The courts have always said that the release of information that would jeopardize lives in ongoing immediate circumstances, like a military operation that's about to occur or has already begun in secret, that would be highly problematic in terms of whether the person who published that information will be protected. So the court's always sort of acknowledged that risk, although it's never had a case like that. But it's always said that that might be a situation because the harm is likely imminent and grave. Not that it's an exception to that rule, but that may be an example of that rule. So I do think that that's exactly what the court has in mind when it says that the press could be punished if it discloses information that's likely imminently to cause a grave harm. But that's never happened. The other thing that I want to suggest, which is an additional complication, is that the media have changed profoundly. The mass media have changed profoundly. We now have essentially the capacity of almost any person, not just WikiLeaks, but almost any person, to have access to worldwide audiences through the Internet. So whereas Daniel Ellsberg needed the Washington Post or the New York Times to get the visibility that he wanted to get back in 1970-71, today all you need to do is post stuff on the Internet. And that changes dramatically the potential equation, because the mass media, for the most part, has been reasonably responsible. Let me qualify it. The mass media have been, in my opinion, responsible about this, which is one of the reasons there has never been a prosecution, is that even though the government is often very upset with the disclosures of the Pentagon Papers or with the National Security Agency surveillance program or with the tortures, rendition, and made all sorts of noise about prosecutions, they've never prosecuted them because when they look carefully, they see that they couldn't meet the legal standards. And part of the reason for that is because the mainstream press really are fairly thoughtful and professional about this. With the Internet now existing, the capacity of irresponsible, non-professional organizations or individuals to create worldwide access to information that on reflection maybe really shouldn't be disclosed is a danger that is different than what existed even 25 years ago. And that does pose a serious problem. Now, WikiLeaks, I think, is probably regarded as a fairly responsible agency, like a newspaper, like the New York Times or Washington Post. But that doesn't mean that if WikiLeaks said, we're not going to touch this, that the leaker couldn't have gone to some other website or even posted it himself. So from that standpoint, there's a much greater capacity, for better and for worse, than there used to be. And the extent to which we could rely upon mainstream responsible media to act reasonably, even if the government disagreed with them, is now undermined by the ability of people to go to so many other entities to get international visibility.
Yeah, and that just, not that WikiLeaks, those people need to be defended by me, but I think it is worth mentioning that in the reporting on this issue, it is reported that, in fact, what they did was they went over the material, they looked for names of people whose safety would be compromised if they were to come out, and they removed those names before they released the document. So they were trying to address this particular concern.
Right. No, that's exactly right.
But then that does get to the question of if this material had fallen into the hands of some individual or some other organization that didn't have that sort of concern, and they just said, well, let's just let it rip and put it out there, then what?
Well, I mean, then depending on what the information contains, if there's information in there that would satisfy the standard of likely imminently to cause grave harm, they could be prosecuted for that. I mean, there is a legal standard. There can be prosecutions. It's just that they are it's an extremely high barrier. But the court's never said that there's absolute protection for revealing information that is damaging to national security. I mean, basically, I think the standard would be that it has to be information that's not really valuable and that has caused a likely and imminent grave harm. Let me give you an example, by the way, of why I think the valuable element of this is so important.
Mm-hmm.
Suppose a newspaper publishes the true fact that the United States has murdered 20 Taliban prisoners of war, people they've captured on the battlefield, and that they disclose that information. And before they disclose it, they do a reality check with the government, and the government doesn't deny or admit the truth of it. But it says, look, if you publish this information, then the Taliban, who have, let's assume they've also captured American soldiers, are going to kill 20 American soldiers. That we guarantee that based on their prior behavior. And nonetheless, the newspaper decides to publish the information. Well, that information has a likely and imminent risk of creating the death of 20 American soldiers. And in fact, let's assume it happened, just like the government warned. I would say, even in that situation, the value of the publication, in fact, does sufficiently outweigh the 20 lives. And I don't mean to be crass about it, but the truth is the American people need to know that their military is executing prisoners of war. And if the price of that is going to be, unfortunately, the loss of those lives, that's just the price we have to pay. And the answer to the argument of, well, we can't sacrifice the innocent American lives, is that's what we do by going to Afghanistan. I mean, if that's the argument, then we shouldn't be going into any war ever. So that's an example of a situation where I think even though the publication of the information could likely imminently cause grave harm, that it's still the case that the government could not successfully prosecute.
Mm-hmm. Well, that again, that's and I'm sure that there were people who would strongly disagree with you, who would take the other position, would say that if in fact publishing if going with that story would mean that the Taliban would go out and execute an equivalent number of U.S. soldiers that it had captured, that they would say that would be good enough reason not to do that story. So then, I guess it sort of comes back to this question: well, in a case like that, really, who decides and how should they decide?
Well, the who decides is clear. It would be the courts under, mm-hmm. under our existing system. Mm-hmm. The courts who have the responsibility of, in the final analysis, applying the First Amendment, would decide whether the publication was constitutionally protected in the same way they did in the Pentagon Papers case. And I believe in the situation, in the hypothetical I posited, that the courts would say is that you cannot punish the speech in that context because the American people must know if their military are murdering illegally prisoners of war, and that you cannot keep that information from the American people legitimately. And again, if you take the argument that, well, this is terrible because it'll cause 20 Americans to die, if you take that seriously, then it means you can't fight wars. And when you fight wars, you're saying, yes, we think it's worth it to have 55,000 Americans die or 6,000 Americans die. So you're making judgments that say there are benefits that outweigh the lives of all the soldiers who die. And the value of an informed citizenry should be extraordinarily high. How many soldiers would we be willing to lose to preserve the transparency of our government?
We're coming down to the point here where we have about a minute or two left. This is, as I think someone who wrote the introduction or the foreword to one of your recent books, The Top Secret Book, another legal colleague who deals with some of the same issues, clearly writes something like, well, you know, he writes, the tension between government secrecy and freedom of the press, so apparent today, is hardly new. Well, it's true. It's not new. Will we be continuing to have this argument every time that there is a particular case? Are we going to re-argue this?
Sure. And because in an open and free society, the way we come to better conclusions over long time periods is by continuing to discuss those issues and debate them. And that's what the First Amendment is fundamentally about, is that we don't close off discussion or debate because we know that there are not right or wrong answers on hard questions, and that the more we think about them, the more information we have, the more we understand them, the more points of view we hear, the more likely it is that we'll eventually come to better rather than worse answers. And that's the basic presumption of the First Amendment, and you don't want to close off these questions. That's the whole point of what we're talking about. Mm.
And just again, I'm sure we've spoken to this, but just one more time, you in your particular judgment, you think when it comes to exercising discretion about what is or is not released, that by and large, you think the media has been doing a pretty good job?
I think historically that's true. I mean, one way to test it is that the truth is the government has not prosecuted any individual or media outlet for the publication of information. They have prosecuted the leaker. That's different.
Mm-hmm.
And the truth is, despite the outcry of a particular administration at a particular moment because it's annoyed or embarrassed or angry, or even because of legitimate national security fears, there's never been really a sufficiently sustained anger that we even see legislation since 1918, anyway, that attempts to do that.
Well, there we will have to leave it. Our guest, Jeffrey Stone, is professor of law at the University of Chicago. He teaches and writes on constitutional law. If you're interested in this subject and looking back over history on how we thought about it, you might want to take a look at his book, Perilous Times, Free Speech in Wartime, from the Sedition Act of 1798 to the War on Terrorism, published in 2004. Professor Stone, thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.